So why not just do the easy stuff? Why? Because we want to make the tough decisions this year.
The House push for an income tax. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, global warming complicates the challenge of providing basic sanitation services to rural villages.
You thought you had sort of the water and sewer challenge already solved for some communities, and now you're going back to the drawing board.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
To some House members, reintroducing an income tax in Alaska is the best way to close a long-term gap between how much the state government spends and what it raises. But senators are opposed to the plan, leaving a political divide between the two chambers with only 11 days left before the scheduled end to the legislative session. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Two different bills aimed at solving the budget gap are moving through the legislature. The Senate passed SB 26 in mid-March. It lets the legislature draw from the permanent fund to close the gap, and it shrinks the size of the PFD. The bill reduces the nearly $3 billion spending gap, but it doesn't close it all the way. The Senate plans to make up the difference by cutting the budget. A nonpartisan estimate says just passing SB 26 means the state would run deficits averaging more than $500 million per year for the next 9 years. For members of the House majority, like Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton, that's not okay.
When you have a $500 million deficit every single year, what it means is your cuts are going to be like they are this year. You're saying a 5% cut to education this year, but you're saying in their budget that you're going to have to make the same kind of cut additionally next year.
Seaton and others in the House say that's not the only problem with SB 26. They say relying on cuts to dividends and spending would balance the budget on those least able to afford it. Senate Bill 26 would cut the income of the poorest fifth of Alaskans by more than 10%, while it would hardly impact those in the top 1%. Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says the legislature needs to do more than just rely on money from the PFD.
So why not just do the easy stuff? Why not just go after permanent funds for children and fixed income seniors the same as we do for multimillionaires? Why? Because we want to make the tough decisions this year.
The House is putting forth their own bill, HB 115. It draws from the permanent fund to pay for the state government, just like the Senate bill, but it also adds an income tax. It takes steps to balance the impact on low-income Alaskans. Low-income residents would lose just over 8% of income instead of 10%, and high-income residents would lose just under 3% of income. There are disagreements over how the House's current version of a tax would affect Alaska's economy. The House Finance Committee recently changed their income tax proposal. Alaska State Chamber of Commerce President Curtis Thayer says the change prompted the chamber to oppose the bill. Thayer says he's disappointed the bill now taxes income that's exempt from the federal income tax, including some business taxes and college savings plans known as 529 plans.
When we look at a bill that, like I said, not only attacks small businesses, but attacks senior citizen pensions, institutes a death tax, parents that save money on the 529 now get taxed on the interest. It's a pretty much dramatic shift.
Thayer says state spending should be cut more by consolidating school districts and health plans and modernizing technology. Some senators agree that the best way to close the budget gap is with spending cuts. They've cut more than $200 million out of the budget, more than the House this year. Senators also want nearly $500 million more cut over the next 2 years. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says the Senate plan gets the state much of the way to a balanced budget.
The Senate feels the need for this to be the most efficient government as we look to Alaskans and say, we're going to be reducing your dividend, we're going to be making the most wise use of our reserves, and the reality of it is a slight increase in the value of oil along with our cuts or looking at a fuel tax brings us extremely close to balancing the budget.
Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman says the House should separate the permanent fund draw from the income tax and consider the tax later. Last year, disagreement over a long-term budget plan was one reason the session extended a month, and Governor Walker called it back for two special sessions. The House Finance Committee has been discussing House Bill 115 over the past week. It's not clear whether there's enough support for the committee to pass the bill. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Senate will debate a state government budget for the coming year that is $262 million less than the current budget. The Senate Finance Committee's proposed cut is much deeper than the $32 million cut the House passed, but it falls short of the $300 million that the Senate Majority Caucus announced as a reduction goal this winter. Wasilla Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy offered a series of cuts as budget amendments on Monday. They were defeated.
The purpose in this is, as a caucus, the Senate majority has agreed to reduce the budget by $300 million real dollars. This is an attempt to get us as close as possible to that reduction.
One of Dunleavy's amendments would have reduced the budget by another $100 million without allocating where the cuts would be made. Governor Bill Walker's administration would have been tasked with making the cuts. Dunleavy was the only Finance Committee member to vote for the amendment. Senate Finance Co-Chairman Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman said the governor needs clear ideas about where reductions should be made.
It's been said, and the governor's office has said it, unallocated reductions are very difficult to manage.
The biggest Senate cuts are to transportation, education, and health and social services. The University of Alaska would be cut $22 million. University President Jim Johnson says the cut would be devastating. The full Senate was scheduled to begin debating amendments to the budget today, but delayed the discussion to possibly tomorrow. For decades, Alaska has struggled to get running water and sewer systems to its rural communities. An estimated 10,000 people still lack both. And now that job may be getting harder. As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, climate change is exacerbating old problems and creating new ones.
For years, the village of Unalakleet has piped in drinking water from a creek several miles away. The water main runs along the beach, buried underground. Or at least, it was buried. But in the last several years, that beach has taken a beating. City Council member Judy Katungan remembers one storm in particular.
The surf just was pounding. It moved conexes.
Big shipping containers that were sitting out by the water. The storm tore away parts of the bank, exposing the water main. Unalakleet has always had fall storms, but in recent years, the village has lost its armor. Sea ice forms later, and storms have eaten away at the coastline. Katungan says residents worry one big storm could cut off their drinking water supply.
It's very urgent. We've been struggling with water problems ever since that storm.
And it's not just Unalakleet. Communities around the state seem to be dealing with new threats to water and sewer systems from environmental changes linked to global warming. Bill Griffith is with the State Department of Environmental Conservation.
That does feel at times like you thought you had sort of the water and sewer challenge already solved for some communities, and now you're going back to the drawing board.
Griffith has been working on these issues for more than 20 years, funding projects all over the state. And he says there's been a shift in the kinds of projects he's asked to fund. Thawing permafrost is warping water and sewer lines. Along the coast and rivers, erosion is threatening the lakes that communities use for drinking water or the lagoons where they dump sewage. Streams and reservoirs that used to be reliable sources of water are now less reliable.
It's one of those things that you might have been looking at for a while, but you just weren't connecting the dots.
But sometime over the last 5 or 10 years, Griffith says, he realized more and more issues were linked to warmer temperatures. There's no real way to quantify it. The state doesn't track the problem. But Griffith says, from where he's sitting, it's pretty clear. Perhaps the most dire example is the village of Newtok in western Alaska, which has been trying to relocate for over a decade. Erosion has wiped out the sewage lagoon, and residents are now forced to empty their honey buckets into the rivers. Laura Eichelberger is a researcher who visited Newtok last summer to study the health impacts. She described raw human waste and toilet paper floating in the same water where people keep their boats.
I'm almost at a loss for words on how to describe that, because it shows you how few options people have when both of the rivers that they rely on for subsistence are also their sewage lagoon.
And Nutuk's drinking water source is also at risk. It sits about 60 feet from the river, and the village expects to lose it sometime this year. Eichelberger says people are doing a remarkable job of managing under intolerable circumstances, but ultimately, something's got to give.
The environment is now changing faster than we can respond. It's not that we weren't contending with melting permafrost or damage to infrastructure or flooding or erosion before, but the pace of that is problematic.
That pace of change is also hitting the North Slope borough. Last August, the village of Point Lay lost its freshwater source when its reservoir suddenly drained into a nearby river. Permafrost separating the lake from the river had disintegrated. Kenneth Robbins is an advisor to the borough mayor.
You have to say it's climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it. The permafrost is more active than it has been in the past.
He says permafrost temperatures are rising. The active layer, which thaws each year, is expanding. And sudden disasters are more likely, like Point Lay's reservoir simply disappearing.
Yes, it's a natural lake. Yes, it's near a natural river. They both change in shape. And historically, did those things happen? Absolutely. But I think they're happening more often now than they used to.
The borough bought a desalination unit in case Point Lay or another village has to rely on salt water. There's an effort underway to drill groundwater wells. And the borough is now using different engineering techniques to install water and sewer lines into permafrost. Whatever happens, Robin says he's confident that people on the North Slope can figure it out.
The culture and the people have lived here for thousands of years. I think if they've proven anything, they adapt.
And communities across the state are scrambling to do just that. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
If you are seeing climate change impacts on infrastructure in your community, Alaska's Energy Desk wants to hear about it. Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org or find Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a commercial fishery for the Lower Kuskokwim could be on track for this summer.
We understand the pain, I think, that a lot of people have gone through by not having a commercial processor in town.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
At the U.S. Capitol, Alaska Congressman Don Young is known to berate Democrats and environmentalists who oppose his efforts to get a road for King Cove. Young accuses them of being indifferent to the lives of his constituents, the Alaska Natives who reside in a remote, isolated community. But at a hearing today, the witness who spoke against the road was also an Alaska Native from a remote, isolated community. As Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, this isn't just about the road.
Young glared across the dais in the hearing room at the Democrats on the Natural Resources Subcommittee. One of them had just spoken against the 11-mile road for King Cove, saying it would harm waterfowl habitat in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Young says it would save lives.
The day that this Congress will take and love a goose that's not going to be harmed over a human life, shame on you. I'm not going to tolerate that. If you want to kill people, go out and kill them. But don't do it because you're being stupid.
Della Trumbull, speaking for her fellow residents of King Cove, told the subcommittee they want the road so they can drive to the all-weather airport at Cold Bay, so they won't have to endure dangerous flights from their town when they need medical care.
And I, for one, know this firsthand, as I witnessed my daughter's airplane crash land on the field in King Cove 4 years ago.
The details change, but this is how hearings on the road have gone for decades. Trumbull says she's been to Washington at least 30 times to advocate for the road. Less usual was the type of witness who spoke against the road.
My name is Myron P. Nanning Sr. from Hooper Bay, a village in western Alaska.
Nanning was, until last year, president of the Association of Village Council Presidents. Now he's the board president of Hooper Bay's Village Corporation. Nanning's region, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, is hundreds of miles from Eisenbeck, but he says the people in the Delta have traditionally depended on the waterfowl that feed in the Eisenbeck lagoons during the spring and fall migrations. During a break in the hearing, Nanning pointed out that people in his area have been severely curtailed in the number of salmon they can take.
If we're not allowed to fish for salmon, what other food resources would we have be allowed to harvest? That's why migratory birds are just as important for our subsistence uses.
Raising a long-standing dispute, Nanning says commercial fishermen in the eastern Aleutians near King Cove have not faced similar restrictions, and some of the salmon they catch are bound for the YK Delta.
You know, we've gone to the Board of Fisheries to try and get them to recognize the fact that our people on the Yukon or the Kuskokwim need salmon for food, but it seems like big money advocates usually get the best of whoever are the decision makers.
It's an argument King Cove has heard before. The Aleutians East Borough has a web page to debunk the claim that fishermen catch all the northbound salmon at False Pass. Nanning says even if there were plenty of fish in his region, he'd still be fighting the King Cove Road to conserve waterfowl. As for King Cove's need for safe transportation, Nanning says lots of YK villages have it just as bad. Nanning, with some pressing, acknowledged that the Wilderness Society paid for part of his trip to speak against the road. Young did not go after Nanning as harshly as he has other road opponents, but the subcommittee chairman, Representative Tom McClintock, took a swipe at Nanning in a dialogue with Trumbull.
He's not even from those communities?
No. He's from a different region.
But he wants to deny your community the right to build this road. How long have you been studying?
Young later said he doesn't like seeing two Alaska communities pitted against each other. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In Anchorage's municipal elections yesterday, Liberal candidates gained an edge in the assembly, and all but one bond measure passed. Voters also opted to shake up the taxi industry. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, amid low turnout, it was candidates and causes aligned with the current administration who won the day.
Inside a bland conference room on the second floor of the Dena'ina Convention Center in downtown Anchorage, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz watched results scroll past on a projector screen.
I'm looking at numbers, and I just want to see right now, I'm looking to see which precincts have come in to get a sense of how much change you expect to see.
It was still early in the night, with just under half the votes counted, but the results looked good for Berkowitz's administration. At stake in the assembly elections was the kind of relationship the representative body will have with the mayor's office. But the mayor was paying just as much attention to the ballot initiatives. Voters were on track to pass almost all of the bonds put forward by the administration, more than $100 million for schools, infrastructure, park upkeep, and public safety facilities.
I think the fact that the bonds are in strong position is an indication that people of Anchorage feel confident about the direction of the economy.
There were few surprises in the six assembly races, with incumbents holding seats in West and East Anchorage, and former lawmaker Fred Dyson winning an open seat in the Eagle River Chugiak District. But progressive candidates won by large margins in the downtown and midtown races. As results poured in, so did supporters from victorious campaigns. And in somewhat of an upset, a liberal-leaning political newcomer, Suzanne LaFrance, narrowly won the South Anchorage seat that's traditionally been held by conservative representatives. LaFrance says she's a bit surprised by the results, but thinks the positive tone in her campaign helped efforts.
We had a lot of folks who definitely hit the ground, you know, door-to-door, lit-dropping, getting the word out on social media and word of mouth. And if you look at the folks who contributed financially to the campaign, it's a very widespread, you know, broad-based group.
The results nudge the Assembly slightly more to the left of where it currently sits. The Assembly will also see its first two openly gay members, Felix Rivera in the Midtown District and Christopher Constant downtown. Constant says Anchorage is changing.
We've seen a sea change in the last 4 years in this town, and in fact across the country. It's time. You know, there's a saying in the LGBT political communities that if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably being served, right? It's long past the time when we were being served that we get to be at the table, make decisions for ourselves.
At just under 20%, turnout across the municipality was low, even by the standards of municipal elections. Even though assembly races are technically nonpartisan, political groups from both sides put resources behind candidates. Joshua Spring is in charge of organizing volunteers for the Alaska Young Democrats. He says the group aimed efforts at door knocking and phone banking for progressive candidates in every district, though involvement, like turnout, was hardly massive.
I've made probably about 250 volunteer request calls this cycle, and the main thing that I think I heard was people feeling burned out after the last cycle in November. But the people that are here and are involved are hyper-involved.
One bright spot for conservatives was the failure of Ballot Measure 2, which had to do with attaching 14 staff positions to the operations of two new ambulances, a measure that would have cost $23 million over 10 years. On hand at Election Central was former Mayor Dan Sullivan, part of an effort to defeat that proposition.
That's extreme, and I think that was a mistake by the administration to put that out there like that. You know, if you think that these ambulances are something that is as vital, they could have rolled it into the regular budget.
In a proposition about the future of the taxi industry, voters rejected a move to keep the current system and opted to open up the permitting process. The move will put more cabs on the road in the next few years. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska legislature today passed a bill recognizing the contributions of Black Americans in building the Alaska Highway 75 years ago. The bill, proposed by Wasilla Republican David Wilson, establishes October 25th as African American Soldiers' Contribution to Building the Alaska Highway Day. That date marks the day workers completed the last link of the project in 1942. Wilson says historically, little recognition had been given to the Black Americans who, despite facing overt racism and legal discrimination in the country at the time, comprised a third of the workers who built the highway. The Alaska Highway remains one of the largest construction undertakings conducted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Wilson says, quote, "We can't change the past, but we can honor the men who helped pave the way on a project that would ultimately serve as a road to civil rights."
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Commercial fishing could be returning to the lower Kuskokwim this summer. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
These will be shipped up basically across the United States to distributors that would take this product to restaurants and retailers.
Pacific Harvest Seafood President Jim Gonzalez says at least one tender would run down to Quinnahock to buy fish. He plans to ice the silvers down and fly them to market. When Coastal Villages Region Fund closed its platinum processor last year, fishermen in the lower Kuskokwim villages were left without a buyer. Pacific Harvest plans to pay commercial fishermen cash per pound of silver salmon.
We will be at least as high as the previous processor was here, if not higher.
CVRF, the previous processor, paid 50 cents per pound. Gonzalez worked in the Bethel area before as a sales manager for another salmon buyer in the 1990s. He knows working in the remote region will cost his company millions of dollars, but says he feels connected to the area and the people who live here.
We understand the pain, I think, that a lot of people have gone through by not having a commercial processor in town. And it's not just simply a profit motive for our company to be here.
Gonzalez delivered his news to the Kuskokwim Salmon Management Working Group last week. At the meeting, Aaron Potter, a fish biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the state doesn't forecast the silver salmon run, but expects high enough numbers returning this summer to support commercial openings.
We're certainly interested in working with any prospective processor for this area. We'll always base our commercial opportunity based on run size, based on our assessment.
Fishermen would need a limited entry permit to participate in the commercial harvest. Working group member Greg Hoffman Jr. is a commercial fisherman in Bethel. He hopes the processor comes through and opens a local commercial fishery.
I've been talking to my friends and family, and they're looking forward to going out commercial fishing.
Other working group members asked Pacific Harvest to expand its buying upriver to Tulisac. Gonzalez says the company is still developing its plans and will consider the option. The working group also invited Gonzalez to apply to sit in the empty processor seat on the working group to keep the body informed of its plans. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The U.S. Air Force made a special visit to Unalaska yesterday after a hiker found unexploded ordnance from World War II. As KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, a bomb squad destroyed the artillery shell in a controlled explosion.
During the war, hundreds of soldiers were stationed atop Mount Ballyhoo, one of the tallest peaks in Unalaska. Last week, a local hiker found an explosive reminder of that wartime past tucked away in the tundra at the base of the mountain. So,
the Air Force came out and we blew it up.
Chris Honan is the city investigator, and he hosted the explosive ordnance disposal team that flew in from Anchorage to deal with the shell.
It was old World War II. It looked maybe 120 millimeter. It's usually fired like from howitzers type cannons.
Some 75 years after the war, Honan can't be sure why road maintenance turned up this piece of ordnance at this spot, but he has an idea.
It was a good sized round. Probably from training, they had like, 50,000 soldiers. So they probably did some training and fired rounds here and there. It's wartime, so people were always rushing around, throwing stuff around.
Back in the present day, Honan says the EOD squad did not rush the controlled explosion that disposed of the shell. The three-man team studied the ordnance carefully before driving it to the secluded gun range on the far side of the mountain and blowing it up. Civilians were not allowed within sight of the explosion, and the EOD team did not take questions afterward. But Honan says it was fun to watch the blast from his spot, a safe 500 feet away from the detonation.
It wasn't bad. I would say it was probably a couple pounds of C4. You could feel it. You had a little shake.
In his 7 years on the job, Honan says the military has come to the island 4 or 5 times to dispose of World War II ordnance.
It's not too common, but it's good to be on the lookout for it.
Honan reminds Unalaskans to call the police if they come across ordnance on the island. He says civilians should not handle explosives for their own safety. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.